Today, our topics are road rage, noise pollution, gene manipulation, waste disposal, and nature conservation.
And the persons to discuss these topics are all old acquaintances of ours, as you will soon discover.
According to Liikenneturva, an expert organization in traffic safety in Finland, some of the central risk factors causing fatal car accidents are speeding, tailgating, and overtaking. This also seems to apply to other countries. More and more motorists worldwide seem to have developed a new type of disease called road rage, very appropriately translated as rattiraivo into Finnish. Today, there's a group of people here in the studio to discuss this phenomenon. Brenda.
Hello.
Carl.
Hi.
And Robert.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome, all of you. And Mac is going to be your host today. Welcome, Mac.
Thank you, Eva. Well, when you hear the words road rage, what kind of behavior does it bring to mind? Just who is in a rage, and about what?
Well, I get angry if someone tailgates me, showing that in his opinion, and it's usually a he, I'm driving at too low a speed. But I don't think that can be called a fit of road rage.
I don't think so. It's rather the person who's tailgating you that the word applies to, and I consider that a very mild case. That kind of behavior might be called aggressive driving if that driver shows symptoms of aggression.
I read somewhere that in a study of traffic accidents, it was found that in very many of the fatal accidents, the guilty party was very irritated, depressed, excited, or shocked. One of the fatal accidents, for example, was caused by somebody who had recently gone through a divorce.
Yes, and with some added irritation, the critical threshold is crossed, which then leads to road rage. Brenda here just gave us an example of tailgating. Would any of you have any other examples of behavior that could be classified as road rage?
In New York, at least, if you don't push the pedal the moment the light turns green, the car or cars behind you will blast their horns.
And some people tend to get disturbed by anyone driving in a way different from what they think is proper, like the speeders who tailgate you. When finally they pass you, they may make an obscene gesture to add insult to injury. And when they swerve back to your lane, they may brake abruptly.
And at the very least, they will be flashing their headlights.
Have you noticed that this behavior has any connection with a certain type of car? I mean, is it, for example, drivers of sports cars or maybe four-wheel vehicles that are most guilty of showing impatience on the roads?
I don't think there's a difference. But if I really wanted to generalize, I'd say that a small car passing a bigger one seems to trigger a race on the road.
I think that even if these powerful four-wheel drives seem to be more and more common on the roads, their drivers are not necessarily those who are most eager to demonstrate the capacity of their cars.
That's right. But I would still say that purchasing one of those when you can't use all the potential it offers reveals something about the owner, too.
I'd like to point out that even if young people in their old cars are often blamed for being rude in traffic, I think they mostly only race each other. Of course, I'm not saying that that isn't dangerous, too.
But surely there must be a reason for road rage. Can any of you suggest one?
I'd say it's simply traffic congestion. At rush hour, the streets and highways can be so full of cars that you just feel suffocated.
I think almost anything can make a slightly irritated driver overreact, having to wait at the traffic lights, looking or waiting for a parking space.
The unexpected narrowing of a multi-lane highway.
Or, in extreme cases, even waiting for passengers to get into the car.
In the United States, I hear, the problem of road rage is already so big that some experts have founded an association called the International Association of Road Rage Experts. And a Hawaiian traffic psychologist on the net, under the name of Dr. Driving, is there to advise people about how to behave in traffic. Carl, What kind of solution would you suggest to this problem?
I strongly believe that it is the attitudes that need correcting. In the U.S., for example, most driving schools only teach the mechanics of driving, but almost nothing about the psychology of driving. And even that little is being abolished. Due to the budget cuts, many American secondary schools no longer offer a traditional driver's ed, and in some states, the course may not demand more than 6 hours behind the wheel.
Yeah, it's easy to suggest that we start influencing drivers' attitudes, but it's no easy job. Out in the streets, we don't only have skilled drivers, we have a variety of drivers with varying skills and emotional maturity. So the group can easily include what you'd call jerks, too.
One reason for drivers driving too slowly, and thus irritating the driver behind, is the cell phone. I would be willing to accept a law forbidding the use of phones without a hands-free set.
But to answer your question, Mac, there's a lot, of course, they could do if they were willing. They could simply lower speed limits and have stiffer penalties.
And more roads and bypasses could be constructed to avoid congestion. But I still think there are two things of basic importance. One is your parents' example, and the other is that of your peers. I don't know what to suggest to improve the former, but I think that if polite driving could be made socially attractive among the young, and paying attention to others be made a new behaviour code in traffic, we could have a brighter future ahead of us.
Well, that was such a nice wish, Brenda, that I think we'll close this discussion with it. Thank you, each and all of you, for your contribution and opinions. Let's just hope someone who can do something about our theme today was listening to us.
Where's today's paper? Ah, here it is. Listen to this. In Lithakia, on the Greek island of Zakynthos, a 78-year-old retired farmer murdered his neighbor for blasting music too loud. It says here that he only wanted to listen to the evening news in peace. He now listens to the news in a Greek prison, serving a life sentence.
Hard to believe that anyone would actually lose his mind about noise. Did I ever tell you about my neighbour, who seems to be a totally dedicated heavy metal fan, from what I hear, anyway? That terrible noise surrounds me every day. Loud and relatively meaningless screams penetrating the walls and my ears.
I know what you mean. That's noise pollution. Sounds you hear against your will. What disturbs me is the roar of these noisy motorcycles riding up and down the street in the middle of the night. Even at low speed, their engines whine like one of those World War II airplanes in a nosedive.
Yes, there is a lot of noise everywhere. The jarring sound of roadworks and the bleeping of mobile phones.
Still, it can't be helped because the primary sources of noise pollution are also mainstays of modern life. Apart from people who make a racket through stereos, TVs, outdoor concerts, and sports events, the most common noisemakers are airplanes, trains, and cars. Traffic, that is.
Yes. Noise pollution is an environmental problem. The presence of intrusive and unwanted sounds can seriously affect our health. According to a report published by the European Environment Agency, about 450 million people, that's 65% of the European population, are regularly exposed to a 55 decibel noise level, which is high enough to cause annoyance, aggressive behaviour, and sleep disturbances.
True. And noise above 75 decibels can lead to high stress levels, increased heart rates, and potential hearing loss.
I am concerned because the noise level of a discotheque is usually about 80 to 100 decibels, and that of a high-speed train is even more. And as for aircraft...
Yes. It's said that when a plane roars overhead, your heart rate goes up. That has a negative effect on your
nervous system, and it's a factor in heart disease, too. Children seem to be very vulnerable to excessive noise. A study carried out around Munich Airport in 1998 shows that noise from aircraft affects learning abilities in school children.
It seems that sickness is the price we pay for a healthy economy, although it should be the polluter who pays. I think people should complain more. Members of the silent majority. I mean, people who suffer from these acoustic intrusions. I wish they would speak out.
You wish they were louder?
Yes, but taking noisemakers to court can be a long and frustrating process. There's a lot of prejudice against people who complain. It seems that some people would rather move house than face the source of the problem. Besides, the councils are not willing to prosecute. However, the European Commission has proposed a new directive, which, if approved, would set certain guaranteed maximum noise level requirements for outdoor equipment, for lawnmowers, leaf blowers, garbage trucks, and so on.
I'm glad to hear that. The fact is that modern life is not going to quiet down any time soon. But that doesn't mean noise pollution is destined to drive us crazy or make us go deaf. Sensible urban planning, innovative new technology, and creative acoustic architecture, plus some good old-fashioned neighborliness, can go a long way towards restoring peace and quiet. I think we'll find simple solutions for noise pollution, if we put our minds to it.
Do you know, I once visited a small hotel near Los Angeles, California, where travelers could take sonic refreshment. Now, for example, sounds of twittering larks and babbling fountains as the traffic roared down the busy highway just outside the hotel.
Sounds nice. So, Brenda, what's your favorite soundscape?
Well, the faint lisp of snowflakes in winter, the rush of wind through pine trees, and in summer, when insects begin to hum at dawn, you can actually hear the countless wings beating. I think the natural soundscape should be conserved like any other endangered species. Natural parks should be like natural cathedrals. The acoustic environment inside these cathedrals deserve the same respect we have inside our man-made cathedrals. I think people have the right to peace and quiet.
I wonder what this GMO means.
GMO? Well, yes, it means genetically modified origin. In the early 90s, the USA approved the first marketing of genetically modified food, a tomato, in which scientists removed the gene that makes a tomato turn soft and squishy after picking. Nowadays, genetic manipulation is creating beans with more protein, strawberries packed with more natural sugar, tomatoes which contain a cholesterol-lowering protein, and coffee beans without any caffeine. They claim that genetic engineering of plants will not only make foods taste better, but will also reduce the need for pesticides, fertilizers, and water.
Are you saying, then, that with the help of genetics, we'll be able to feed the world's growing population?
Absolutely, yes.
But do you seriously think that big biotech companies are in this to feed the world and improve the environment? I'm sure the big companies see the possibility of making money. The bottom line is to make a profit for the shareholders, isn't it?
Well, yes. But if consumers find these new products hard to swallow, there won't be much profit. It is up to the consumers to decide whether they buy the product or not, isn't it? I think that great improvements to food and farming could result from genetic engineering. There are even visions of such wonders as apples that may permanently vaccinate consumers against illnesses, like hepatitis B, for instance.
Really? I must say all this sounds just too good to be true. But isn't there a serpent lurking in that apple tree, just like in the Garden of Eden? Isn't it possible that a GMO soya bean, for example, might pollinate with its neighbours and produce superweeds? Isn't it possible that GMO foods might expose consumers to new allergens? and that they might upset the balance of microorganisms that naturally live in the human gut? We don't know enough about these things yet, do we? I mean, the potential fallout from these transgenic creations is a mystery. And these genetically engineered crops may turn out to be Frankenstein foods. It's a worrying mystery, if you ask me.
Well, yes, I see what you mean, but I'd like to point out that much of what genetics does is perfectly natural. A fear of gene manipulation is based on the idea that all tampering is harmful. Every time sperm meets egg, recombinant DNA is made. Species are not fixed entities as they evolve from one into another. That's natural evolution. If altering the genetic makeup is unnatural, then people have been performing unnatural acts for a very long time. Man began breeding dogs from wolves some 100,000 years ago. By today, breeding and crossbreeding have yielded dogs ranging from Great Danes to Chihuahuas. The same kind of tampering has produced other domestic animals. Isn't crossbreeding also manipulation? You don't find poodles in nature.
Yes, but the point is that transferring genes into a completely unrelated species is against nature. Man should not try to play God.
But genetic testing is here to stay. It has already become routine. Most pregnant women in their late 30s are offered a chance of a test of abnormality which leads to Down syndrome. It's used to identify a damaged gene and offer the choice of therapeutic abortion.
Where should the line be drawn, however? Should the insurance companies have the right to demand the results of a test to help them to decide how much to charge, or even whether to insure at all? Genetic information means that insurance will no longer be blind.
The great killers of the modern world, heart disease and cancer, are strongly influenced by genes. Is that what the insurance companies are after? Before long, we could learn the probable date of our death. But who on earth would want to know that?
That's a good question, and not an easy one to answer. Anyway, genetics can do a lot more than just test for abnormalities. Gene therapy, for example, gives hope of a cure. It involves replacing a faulty section of DNA. New medicines will be created from the combination of genetic engineering and cloning science. This means that engineered animals can produce milk containing specific proteins for medicines. By the way, do you remember Dolly?
Yes, if you mean Dolly the celebrity sheep. Isn't she the one that shook our sense of identity by being the first clone created from an adult cell?
Yes, that's her. And Dolly had a little lamb, the normal way. That's something, isn't it? Dolly and her lamb charmed even some of those who were uncertain about animal cloning.
But still, question marks hang over cloning science. Dolly opened the doors to human cloning, which presents a serious moral, medical, and political dilemma. A few years ago, Finland imposed a tax on toxic and commercial waste. And this seems to have given birth to a new breed of human being, the fly tipper. Instead of taking the construction waste left from renovating his home or the useless old fridge that has been replaced with a new one to the local dump, the fly tipper chooses a quiet spot in the countryside to offload the junk. Townies, of course, living near urban conurbations are the ones most likely to blame, you might like to say. But you're wrong. Country people behave in the same way. Is it really tax that's the reason for this? In Denmark, they introduced a tax on waste a few years ago, but no noticeable increase in dumping waste was observed. Well, you may say, Denmark is such a densely populated country with no secluded spots where you could dump anything at all without someone noticing it. No, it's not that, at least according to the officials of the Ministry of the Environment. When charges are increased, citizens will have to consider other ways to treat their waste. And that is where sorting and recycling enters the scene. A good example from our country is a man who was taking a load of used bricks to the dump. after he had been told that offloading would cost him as much as buying the same amount of new bricks at a hardware store, he decided to reuse them. What makes people cut corners, you might ask? One group is said to be those calculating people who want to escape paying for dumping. Another is those who claim to be too busy to take their waste to the proper site. There is, of course, a seed of truth in the latter argument. Nowadays, it can be rather time-consuming to dispose of your refuse. No longer are the recycling centres or landfills open day and night so that you can simply turn up and leave your waste there. The sites may be only open on certain days or closed so early that you cannot possibly get there in time. It must be extremely frustrating to arrive at the gate of the site with your load only to find that the municipal dump has closed 10 minutes earlier. The temptation to dump in the nearby woods is understandable, although, of course, not acceptable. In Finland, the cost of the refuse tax plus the 22% value-added tax may be as much as half of the dumping cost. Furthermore, most dumps are likely to have to increase their charges because of a new EU directive, which is expected to come into force retrospectively as of January 1, 2005. The directive requires a certain standard of the dump, plus the fact that it will have to be guarded. Depending on how well or poorly equipped the dump has been, the costs may double or even triple. And there are plans to increase the environmental taxes too, which will then place an extra increase on the dumping costs. What next? Shops are already doing their share of the job. Bottles, cans, milk and juice cartons and the like can be returned. When you buy a new set of car tyres, you pay for disposing of the old ones. Sometimes your local TV or freezer dealer may be kind enough to take your old device when you buy a new one. But there will still be a lot of refuse that may turn out to be problematic. Some big companies are developing robots to break up old cars. Can we perhaps expect someone to invent a municipal robot to help people get rid of all the unnecessary and harmful stuff for good? The last topic today is nature. We're first going to talk about some examples of man's misuse of nature in the course of time, and then deal with what has been or is being done to restore and preserve at least some of what we already thought was lost for good. First, the harm done. Robert, would you like to start?
Thank you. Yes, man has destroyed different species in countless ways. We've hunted them for their meat, fur, and feathers, or to protect our crops and our livestock. We've destroyed their living places through logging, fire, grazing, and drainage. We have brought predators with us and introduced competitors into the environment, such as the whitefish, which eliminated a native species of trout in Scandinavia. We've transported diseases, such as the blight that attacked the American chestnut, or the Dutch elm disease, which was transported from Europe in the course of shipping wood overseas.
Brenda, I think you might like to say a few words about the state of the seas.
Yes, the deep sea organisms are truly among the endangered ones, and the problem is worldwide. The Gulf War bombings of Kuwait's oil refineries devastated the local waters. Another sad chapter in the Book of Damage is the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. The runoff of fertilizer contributes to the death of the coral reef. In San Francisco Bay, there are about 200 non-indigenous species in the area. And as for Europe, the salmon farming industry, aquaculture, pollutes the oceans here by using tons and tons of antibiotics.
Now and again, discussions pop up about the habitats and numbers of some animals. We tend to have very strong opinions, for instance, about the number of bears, wolves, moose, and even reindeer in certain areas in Finland. Would you like to comment on this, Carl?
Well, mine is a layman's opinion, of course.
So am I.
I'm no expert either, by any means.
Well, anyway, I'd like to bring up one point of view, an example of what happened after the elimination of wolves, I guess I can call it that, in northwestern America in the early days of the settlers. With the dominant predator gone, the next biggest hunter, the coyote, assumed the top spot. And what then happens is that as the coyote population explodes, the populations of foxes and badgers, which compete with coyotes for small game, dwindle. At the same time, large prey, like elk, which were once brought down by wolves, begin to multiply excessively, stripping vegetation from the highlands, and with no elk carcasses lying around, scavengers, accustomed to dining on scraps from wolf kills, have to scrounge elsewhere for protein. This is how man shakes the balance of nature.
Excuse me, but I would still like to think about man's situation. In Kenya, for example, where all wildlife is owned by the government, the grazing animals destroy thousands of hectares of produce annually, not to mention their attacks on livestock. Growing tourism has not helped the poor farmer's economy a bit so far. I am really happy that the government, so I hear, is at least considering the possibility of allowing hunting on private land. Being able to sell the meat and skin themselves will make the locals understand the importance of protecting wildlife far better than having them suffer from it.
Thank you, Brenda. And what Brenda just said made me think about the different theme parks with exotic animals that are being founded everywhere. What's your opinion of them?
The Disney Company's latest attraction, Animal Kingdom, has aroused both excitement and criticism.
Isn't that what happens with all Disney parks?
True. But for this particular park, I think it's a fairly successful attempt to instruct as well as entertain. Those who know South Africa say that the Disney Park area really looks like the bushveld. And the Florida landscape has been meticulously turned into the same kind of terrain as that which is natural to all those animals imported from the African savanna.
And what about the criticism?
Because of the technology hidden there, it is said it is just a high-tech amusement park masquerading as research centers. They're also accused of several deaths of animals, but I suppose the animals die in captivity and freedom alike.
Well, yes, I think they do. But I'm afraid our time is up. Well, we didn't expect to be able to solve the problems of nature conservation or animal extinction, but I hope we've been able to give our listeners some idea of what is and has been going on. Thank you all.
And Mani and I will also like to thank you for your attention. The next time will be test time. Goodbye for now from us.